Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Viljandi here, and welcome to this 8-day retreat titled Galuk Mahamudra. Maybe we can start with some introductions first, just to sort of get to know everyone a little bit here. So I'll just introduce myself. Many of you know who I am because you've been here a few times before, but just to give a brief introduction for anyone new who's not been to this retreat before. My name's Glenn Svensson. I'm from Australia. I grew up in Australia. I have a Bachelor of Science in IT, so my previous career was in the IT business. So I was there for 10 years. And then some time ago, I did a couple of courses in Buddhism in India and Nepal. And then I went and did a 7-year master's program in Buddhist philosophy in Italy. I finished that in 2004. I did a year or so retreat in Spain on the side of a mountain. And then for about 8 years, I've been based mainly in Dharamsala in India, at Tushita Meditation Center, running courses and retreats there, but also then doing various other courses and retreats in a few other different countries in the world. Now I find myself more based in Europe. And about 5 years ago, Mick, who many of you know, invited me to come to Estonia to lead a retreat. He had this place in mind, and I said, yes, sounds like a good idea. Very much like this place. I think it's a very ideal place to doing retreats, and I've been coming back every year for the last 5 years, and this is the first time I've been here in the winter, and I'm very much looking forward to this retreat here this week. Before we begin, I'd just like to look at a little bit the logistics. Tet has already talked about a lot of the logistics, but just to go through the retreat structure so we have that clear. The schedule is posted on the door there. I don't know, is the schedule in the main building? There's a schedule in the main building, and then there's the bell ringer for each session. But just to go through the sessions, just to have a clear idea how the day is going to unfold. So today now we're just doing an general introduction up until 6 o'clock, and then we'll have dinner. And then 7:30 this evening, we're going to do an introduction to meditation, because a large component of this retreat, of course, is meditation. So I'm going to give an introduction into meditation, a very general introduction into meditation this evening, because we're going to be launching straight into the meditation first session tomorrow morning, and I don't want to be really talking in those early morning sessions. So I'm going to give a lot of the information for that this evening so we can go straight into the meditation tomorrow morning. And then from tomorrow till Friday, we have the same schedule. So 5:45, the wake up. 6:15 here with Tet, you'll be doing the eight form moving meditation in a way to sort of get yourself really woken up and stretch the body a little bit. Very good for meditation preparation. So that'll take about, I think, 20 minutes, so about till 6:35, and then you'll have 5 or 10 minute break before the first meditation. So the meditation will be here 6:45. So remember, as I said before, it's very important to be on time, because each session throughout the day will begin with meditation. So if you're 2 minutes late, everyone's already sat down, started to meditate, the door creaks and opens and closes, it's a little bit disturbing. So please be on time for each of the sessions, because we will begin every session with meditation. The morning session before breakfast will be just meditation, so it's a 45-minute session. So what we're going to do there is we're going to have 2 20-minute sessions with a little 2-minute break in the middle. There'll be a little bell going for the beginning and for the break. In the 2-minute break, then that's not really a time to get up and walk around and get a cup of tea and so forth. But if you need to stretch your legs, you can stretch your legs. You can stand up in your place very quietly, and then another 20-minute session and then finish. So that'll bring us up to 7:30. Breakfast next door here at 7:30. Then the second session will start at 9 o'clock. So again, 9 o'clock session, I really want to dedicate to mainly to meditation. So again, we're going to do two meditation sessions with a little 2 minute break in the middle. And then we'll have a little bit of time left over in that session where in that short time, I'm going to review what we did the previous day just to keep it fresh in our mind. And then we'll have a morning tea break from 10:15 till 10:45, half an hour tea break. And then the third session of the day, 10:45 till 12, again, we'll begin with a meditation. We'll do one 24-minute meditation session. And then after that, we'll start to work through slowly this text here, which I'll start to talk about tomorrow. Then lunch will be at 12 o'clock. We'll have a two-hour break for lunch, 12 till 2. And then in the afternoon, we'll have three sessions, each 1 hour long. So each of those sessions, again, we'll start with a meditation. And then the second half of the session, we'll go back into the text a little bit and talk a little bit about some of the topics there. Before I go any further, there's sort of three main areas of practice in the text. The first part of the text talks about the foundation practices. These are often called the preliminaries. But I don't really like to use that word because when people see that, they go, oh, that's for beginners. Okay, I'll do that now. But now I'm not a beginner anymore, so I don't want to do that because that's just for beginners. And this is a big mistake. So these foundation practices are the foundation, which means they are something we need to build as a beginner and we need to keep working on them as we progress and not sort of think they're just something to do as a beginner and then throw them out. So therefore, these are practices we're going to be focusing on in this retreat. And in particular, we're going to focus on these foundation practices in the first session after lunch. Because that first session after lunch often be a little bit sort of drowsy from lunch and so forth. And these sort of practices tend to be a little bit more active than some of the quiet meditation practices. So that's the good time to do them. So the session after lunch is going to be devoted to these sorts of practices. Every day we're going to do that. The next main area of this text of the Mahamudra practice is the Shamatha practice. This is, of course, a concentration practice, simply to develop our concentration skills, developing a calm, clear, and focused mind. This type of practice is generally best to do in the morning when we're most fresh and alert and focused. So this is what we're going to be focusing on in the morning practices. The meditation before breakfast, after breakfast, and the meditation before lunch. We're going to be working on the Shamatha practice. Then the third main area of practice in this text is the Vipassana practice or the wisdom practice. And so this is what we're going to be working on or meditating on, these types of practices in the afternoons. So the first session after lunch will be this area of practice, and then the last two sessions before dinner, we're going to be working on the Vipassana practice. So that's where we're going to meditate on the Vipassana, do the meditations. And then that'll bring us up until... So each afternoon session is 1 hour long with a little 30-minute tea break in between. Again, each of those sessions will start with a meditation and then we'll go talk a little bit more about the text for the rest of that session. And that'll bring us up till 6 o'clock, dinner at 6 o'clock till 7:30. And then 7:30 in the evening, we're going to be focusing on, as Lawrence was mentioning, these four immeasurables practices, this often called the compassion wing of practice. Because often what I find is that people who go into particularly these two types of practices quite intensively get completely unbalanced, because these are very intensive self-absorbing type practices, and it can be, if you're only doing these intensively, you can really become quite unbalanced. So really need to balance this with the other wing of practice, the compassion wing of practice. You know, we often hear about the two wings of practice of wisdom and compassion. So we're going to balance both shamatha and vipassana with some compassion practice. So we're going to be looking at the various types of practices we can do that. That's going to be in the evening session after dinner. So that's going to be dedicated to those types of meditations. So that's going to be the structure for then the next 6 days, from tomorrow through till Friday. And then on the last morning, we're going to have the same practice set up as before breakfast, the eight moving point meditation with Tet, and then the shamatha practice before breakfast. Then we're going to have a little bit longer breakfast on the last morning till 9:30, because I think you have to clear out the rooms and so forth. And then from 9:30 till 10:30, I'll give then a lot of sort of advice, practice advice about what to do with this when you go home, you know, how to integrate it into your daily life and so forth. And then after that, we'll do a little bit of a sort of a wrap-up feedback sort of session. And so we'll be finishing, I think, about 11:30, then having lunch, and then on our way. So that's the structure for the retreat. Is there any questions about the structure of the schedule? Anything that's not clear? And as Tet mentioned, we're going to be working with silence in this retreat. It's always helpful to be very silent. We've got very nice silence outside. And to help promote inner silence, then it's good not to be talking, not to be emailing and texting and so forth. This is not going to be very conducive. So today, I think it's not very good to get to know each other, so we're not going to start silence until when you go to bed tonight. So after this session, during dinner, after this evening session, right up until you go to sleep, then feel free to get to know other people in the retreat, or if you need to work out some logistics about your room and so forth, speak to Tet or the other people here. In the evening, or what I'd recommend after dinner, if you want to keep to chat a little bit, to be a bit respectful of others. There may be other people who are going to bed early, so if you're talking loudly in your room or in that area over there, maybe a bit disruptive, so be mindful of that. But when you go to bed, then silence begins. So, of course, silence when you wake up tomorrow morning. And then we'll be going through silence right up until Friday evening. So that period will be silence. Of course, in some of my sessions, when we're going through the text, particularly in the later in the morning or in the afternoon, if there are any questions that you don't understand, then there's an opportunity then to ask questions about what we're covering in this text. Or you may have some questions about the actual practices that we're doing, so then you can ask questions about the meditation. You're having certain difficulties or experiences, you want to know about that. So that's an opportunity to ask that. But outside of the sessions, then to really maintain that silence. And I think if you do that, then one, you won't disturb other people, and two, you're going to get the most out of this retreat. And often I hear people at the end of these sorts of retreats, when they're giving feedback, that's one of the things that they value most about doing these retreats, is that opportunity to be silent. Because in our life in general, we don't even have one day to be silent. We're always chatting, emailing, texting, talking. I mean, we never have an opportunity to be quiet. And as long as we're caught up in this, it's very hard to really develop ourselves, because we're always distracted. Whereas what you'll find here, particularly people who've not really done so much of this sort of retreat before, is that by shutting down all that chit-chat, talking and texting and so forth, it gives you the space for things to, so insights to come up in your mind, for ideas to develop, and to really get to know yourself much better, and to really get the most out of what we're looking at and the meditations as well. So I really encourage you to be really quiet, and then I think you're going to get the most out of this retreat. Again, if you have any logistic concerns, maybe the toilet's flooding your room or something, then of course you'll need to go and speak to Tet or some of the people here. But other than that, then really to be quiet and silent would be most helpful. Okay, so that's a little bit about logistics. I'd like to now talk a little bit about sort of a bit of a background to Buddhism to give a little bit of context to where this Mahamudra fits into the bigger Buddhist picture, so that we sort of, before we jump into Mahamudra, we can sort of know where it fits within all the various Buddhist practices. But before I start that, is there any last questions about any logistical matters about the retreat? Anything that Tet or myself haven't made clear that you feel is important? Maybe those people also from Lithuania who came late, maybe Tet, you can at dinner explain a few points to them. Okay, so if you want to see Tet when we finish here, he'll explain a few of the things that maybe is important to know about. Like, where's the food? Okay, so let's have a look a little bit of a sort of the bigger picture of Buddhism and see where Mahamudra fits into that bigger picture. When the Buddha, and the Buddha lived about 2,500 years ago in India, of course, when he taught after he achieved enlightenment for 45 years, then his various teachings started to spread through India and then started to spread out of India. And they spread from India primarily in two ancient languages. The first was Pali. And then Buddhism at that time spread initially down to Sri Lanka and then spread up through the northeast into Burma, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, down through Southeast Asia. So in all of those Buddhist traditions now, when they refer back to the original texts, they'll refer back to the Pali texts. These traditions now collectively are called the Theravada tradition. And these traditions are primarily sort of based on the very core teachings the Buddha initially gave, the teachings on the Four Noble Truths. And within the Four Noble Truths, then, what we find is that the goal of the spiritual path is to achieve personal liberation from suffering, to achieve the goal of what's called nirvana. So within the Pali, within the Theravada traditions, then they talk about the goal of the spiritual path is nirvana, the personal liberation from suffering. Also, Buddhism spread from India also through the Sanskrit language. And at that time, it spread up through the northwest of India, what's now sort of Afghanistan, Pakistan. It spread up this way, over the Himalayas, onto the Silk Route, and it went across into China, Korea, Japan, down to Vietnam. And then a little bit later, it spread again over the Himalayas into Tibet. So all of those traditions now, when they go back to the original text, they will go back to the Sanskrit texts. And collectively, those traditions now are called the Mahayana traditions. And in the Mahayana traditions, then A lot of their teachings are based on what's called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And within these teachings from the Buddha, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, then what we see is that the goal of the spiritual path is enlightenment. Not just the goal of personal liberation from suffering, but the further goal of complete enlightenment. The reason being, of course, is that in this state, a fully awakened state, we can be most effective in helping others be free of suffering. So here, the goal of the spiritual path is enlightenment so that we can help to liberate everyone else from suffering as well. So these are a little bit sort of the traditions that evolved from the teachings of the Buddha. And as I mentioned here, in the Mahayana traditions, Tibetan Buddhism is one of those traditions, that Buddhism spread through the Sanskrit language initially over the Himalayas in the 8th century to Tibet. And at that time, it was through the great Indian master Padmasambhava. And through those teachings that he brought into Tibet, we have the first school of Tibetan Buddhism being formed. We have four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. So again, around the 8th century, we have great masters like Shantarakshita and Padmasambhava coming from India to Tibet. And through their teachings, we have the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism being formed. Nyingma is a Tibetan word which literally means old school or original school. And in the Nyingma tradition, again, coming mainly through Padmasambhava, the system of practice that was introduced is now referred to as called Dzogchen. Dzogchen is a Tibetan word which often is translated as great perfection, in Sanskrit Mahasandhi. So Dzogchen is the sort of normal system of practice that is taught within the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. And that was around from the 8th century. Shortly after that time, a king came to power in Tibet who really didn't like Buddhism and tried to wipe out Buddhism in Tibet. And so for a couple of centuries, Buddhism went sort of underground a little bit in Tibet. And then around the 10th, 11th century, some more Indian masters came over the Himalayas into Tibet to revitalize Buddhism in Tibet. And through their efforts, we have the other three schools of Tibetan Buddhism slowly being formed. We have the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. This coming through great Indian masters such as Tilopa and Naropa, who had great Tibetan students, Marpa, and then probably the most famous yogi of Tibet, Milarepa. And the system of practice that was brought into Tibet through these great masters, which form the basis of the Kagyu school, is in fact Mahamudra. So the system of practice that we're going to be looking at in this text is coming through that lineage, through those great Indian masters, Tilopa, Naropa, into Tibet, Marpa, Milarepa, Gampopa, and so forth. And we'll talk a little bit more about that history once we start to look at this text. Then the third school we have in Tibet is the Sakya school, and they also, around the 11th century, some great masters came into Tibet introducing a system of practice called Lamdre. Lamdre is a Tibetan word. Mahamudra, of course, is Sanskrit. Lamdre is a Tibetan word. Lam means path, Dre means result. So this is the system of practice that is normally taught within the Sakya school of Tibetan Buddhism. And around the same time as this, we have another great Indian master, Atisha, bringing Buddhism into Tibet around the 11th century, 10th, 11th century. And he introduced a couple of systems of practice in Tibet. One system that is widely practiced in all of the four schools is called Lojong, or mind training, it's called sometimes. Very pithy instructions. He also introduced into Tibet a system of practice called Lam Rim. Which a number of you are probably familiar with. Again, Lam means path, Rim means stages, stages of the path to enlightenment. And this system of practice then was adopted by early Tibetan Buddhists called the Kadampas, who then continued this lineage of system of practice. And then around the 14th, 15th century, great Tibetan master Lama Tsongkhapa then really expanded upon the Lam Rim approach to practice, and through his efforts we have the fourth school of Tibetan Buddhism being formed, the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism. And so within those four schools, these are the main systems of practice that are taught. In this retreat, we're going to be following what's called Geluk Mahamudra, which is actually a little bit of a synthesis of the Mahamudra tradition coming through the Kagyu masters with Lama Tsongkhapa's Lam Rim, or teachings in the Geluk system. And we'll talk more about that later. So this is a little bit where the Mahamudra fits. So remember, Mahamudra is within the Mahayana tradition. It's a system of practice that was brought into Tibet through great Indian masters, forming the basis of the Kagyu tradition. And we're looking at a particular variation of this system of practice that was developed within the Geluk school through that great Tibetan master Lama Tsongkhapa. So I'll talk more about that later. A little bit of basic background. So anything there that's not clear? Anyone would like to ask any questions about any of this? So both the Kagyu and Sakya schools started to form around the 11th century. And then the Geluk school started to form around about the 14th, 15th century.
Could you please explain a bit more about Sakya Lamdi? Sakya school?
Yeah. Lamdri. Lamdri, Tibetan word. Lam means path, Dre means result. So it's a system of practice that looks at the path together with the result. So what we find, and I don't really want to go into it because it gets quite complicated, but within these four schools, within these systems of practice, one way of sort of distinguishing them very generally is both the Mahamudra and Dzogchen practices look at the spiritual path from the perspective of the result. The Lam Rim is the stages of the path. So it's looking from the perspective of the cause, the path. Whereas Lam Dre is a little bit a sort of in between that. It's looking forward, but also looking from the perspective of the result. So Lam Dre is sort of a little bit, very loosely speaking, a little bit sort of, in terms of perspective, a sort of a bit of a mix of these two perspectives. But that's a very general, I mean, of course, there's much more to it than that. But if we want to keep it simple, that's one way we can talk about it.
Also, especially I think in Lam Rim, there's kind of a strict division between the sutra and tantra levels. Yeah. So how does then Mahamudra relate to this division?
I think I'll answer that in the context of the text because it addresses this very point. This distinction comes up in the text, so I think your question will be answered as we go through the text. But yes, there is a difference there.
I have a question. Maybe it's very exact to this issue, but I have read a lot and also Kabbalah. It remembers very much this Buddhistic teaching, Jewish Kabbalah.
Kabbalah.
Yeah. Is it this Kabbalah, has it came from some of these teachings, spread to European part or any comment?
I mean, of course, there's a lot of speculation about various different traditions and the origins and so forth. But what we can sort of understand is that all of these, I think, sort of traditions like this in Kabbalah and so forth, are all looking for the truth, the underlying reality. And so I think any tradition that's trying to do that, who is approaching that, then I think at the surface, a lot of different traditions look very different. But the deeper you go in any tradition, I think the closer they come. Maybe the language they use is different, the terminology is different, but you should find at the deeper level, all of these traditions seem to be more or less talking about the same thing. I mean, if there is one underlying reality, then if we're all getting close to it, then our explanations should be at least quite a lot of overlap. So, of course, if we see that, then we could speculate, oh, they came from the same person. Or we could say that people within those traditions went deep enough to be able to experience the same reality. So both of those alternatives, of course, are plausible. And, you know, it could be that historically there was some mixing of these things, but I'm no historian, so I don't know. But certainly, even if there wasn't, I think we can say that if people within these various different traditions, maybe which existed in different areas of the planet, and there maybe wasn't much communication in those days, if they are really coming down to the underlying reality, then, you know, you would think that what they're talking about should be fairly similar. You know? Anything else? Very good question, and that's leading me into the next topic. So we can use our handout for this. In fact, in the middle of the handout, so at the start of the handout, of course, we've got 15 or 16 pages of the text that we're going to be following. And then immediately after that, the first handout you have is this three vehicles. So we're going to have a look at that now, and then hopefully answer this question and some other questions. So let's sort of have a look, an overview of these three vehicles to get a little bit more of a, as the question related, is a little bit more of an idea of how Theravada and Mahayana and also we hear about Vajrayana or Tantra, how they fit together. what are their similarities and what are the differences? So that's what we're going to try to make a little bit more clear here. So as we briefly saw earlier, the Theravada traditions are based on the Four Noble Truths teachings coming from the Pali tradition. And there, the goal of the spiritual path is to achieve nirvana. Personal liberation from suffering. And this cycle, this state we find ourselves in, and we're cycling in this state life after life, in Buddhism this cycling is called samsara. So often we hear people say, you know, we're trying to get out of samsara and to nirvana. But of course samsara and nirvana are not places. This is not samsara, and nirvana is not some place we end up in some alternate reality. Samsara and nirvana are state of mind. If our mind is polluted by mental afflictions such as attachment, anger, jealousy, and so forth, we are stuck in a state of samsara. Once we get rid of those pollutants and we purify the mind of them, then we're in a state of nirvana. So they're just states of mind, they're not places. To strive for the goal of nirvana, we need to have an aspiration for that. Now, of course, we tend to look out there for happiness. You know, where can I find happiness? And we end up with a lot of a craving and attachment to pleasant things, a lot of aversion to unpleasant things, hoping that if we do that sort of controlling is good enough, then we'll find some sort of peace and happiness. But, of course, our experience is that we will never find any lasting happiness out there. So, first then, we need to develop the aspiration for this. So we need to turn our attention inwards and look for the source of happiness and suffering within ourselves, and then strive for this goal. So the aspiration that we need to develop, we see here, is often translated as renunciation. But this is a classic example of how terminology creates confusion, because the original Pali and Sanskrit words had very precise meaning, and also the Tibetan written language was designed for Buddhism. When Buddhism came to Tibet, there was no written language. They developed it to be able to translate the Sanskrit texts. So the Tibetan words also are very precise in meaning. But then, of course, when it came from Tibetan or Sanskrit to English, then often these terms, there is no word in English that has the same meaning. So then the translator is forced to pick a word that sort of is similar. And often the word they pick has other meanings in the English language. And then when we see that, we think, oh, that's what they mean, when in fact it's not. And also sometimes the translator didn't really understand what the original word meant and then picked a word that actually is quite misleading. This is a classic example. As we see in your chart here, the original Sanskrit word is nisavana. In Tibetan, ne chung. Both of those words literally mean to emerge from, to get out of. So they are the aspiration to emerge from samsara to nirvana. That's what they literally mean. This word renunciation doesn't seem to have that meaning. Renunciation has the meaning of giving up something. What this is talking about, which is helpful in the word is that we need to give up looking out there for happiness. In other words, we need to give up attachment to pleasure. That's sort of what renunciation's sort of pointing at. But that's not what the original term was talking about. I mean, of course we need to do that, but the original term is the aspiration to emerge from samsara to nirvana. So when we see the word renunciation, that's what we need to understand. That what we're really talking about is the aspiration for liberation from samsara, the aspiration for nirvana. Someone who's achieved the goal of nirvana, of course, is called an arhat. Someone who has arhat often translated into English is like foe destroyer, someone who's destroyed the enemy. And of course, the enemy is the mental afflictions. Once we get rid of our mental afflictions that are polluting our mind, we can achieve the goal of nirvana. What practices do we need to engage in to achieve the goal of nirvana? Normally here, in the Theravada traditions, what the presentation that you see is the Noble Eightfold Path. Which are briefly listed in the practices here. And then what we see there is that these eight practices can be condensed into three core areas of practice, here called the three higher trainings. And the three higher trainings here, and we see how the Eightfold Path is grouped or subsumed into those three trainings. The first is ethics, of course, ethical lifestyle, avoiding harmful behaviour as the basis of all Buddhist traditions. On that basis, we engage in the concentration practice. Developing a calm, clear, focused mind. And we need this as a basis for the third practice, the wisdom practice. Because, of course, how to achieve the goal of nirvana is we need to eliminate the mental afflictions from our mind. We need to, and these mental afflictions are based on a false view of reality. And so we need to eliminate this false view of reality, this ignorance in our mind. So therefore we need to develop wisdom, the wisdom realizing the nature of reality. But of course here, it's not just talking about having a correct intellectual understanding of reality. In fact, some of us may have that right now. We may have a correct understanding of how things exist, but we're still suffering. It's because intellectual understanding is not enough. Because our ignorance and mental afflictions are created through our instinctive habits. Our instinctive habits is to see reality in a wrong way. If we want to overcome that, then we need to bring our intellectual understanding of reality into experience. We need to come to directly see the nature of reality in meditation. To be able to do that, we need a calm, clear, and focused mind. We need concentration. So this is the basis of the wisdom practice. And here, the wisdom practice, of course, as we see, sometimes is referred to as vipassana or vipassana. Many of you are probably more familiar with this is the Pali word, vipassana. The Sanskrit word is vipassana. In both of those words, of course, vi means higher, superior. Passana or passana means to see. So vipassana or vipassana means higher seeing beyond. Normally this is translated into English as insight or special insight. So here, of course, we're talking about insight into the nature of reality. And within the Theravada tradition, when we talk about Vipassana practice, what we see here is that we are talking about three insights we're trying to develop in the spiritual path. Here called the three marks of existence. So in the Theravada tradition, Vipassana practice is coming to realize these three marks of existence. The first is impermanence. And impermanence here, of course, means to realize that things are changing moment by moment. Again, I think all of us, without exception in this room, intellectually accept this idea. Science has proven it. We learned it at school. I think none of us have a problem in believing or accepting intellectually that things are changing moment by moment. But is that helping us in our life? That knowledge? Is it? Not really. I mean, if we constantly think about that in our daily life, maybe it would help a little bit. But we don't even constantly think about it. We know it and we forget it, and we don't remember it in our daily life behavior. So if we want this to be of benefit to us in our life, we need to bring it from intellectual understanding to experience. We need this as a basis. If we can cultivate a calm, clear, focused mind, and then we meditate on this, we can bring that intellectual understanding into experience. We can taste and directly see things changing moment by moment. And then that can be brought into our daily life, so that we can experientially see things as changing moment by moment in our life. Then we'll be much more in harmony with reality. And you'll find that simply having a little bit of a taste and experience of this will have a dramatic positive impact in your life. You'll find your craving and attachment for pleasant things will dramatically reduce. You'll find your aversion to unpleasant things will dramatically reduce. So already this has a dramatic positive impact on our life. But of course we need to do more than this. We need the second insight here. Insight into suffering. Which actually here is a translation of a Sanskrit word, dukkha. And this is to come to realize the nature of our very existence, that our experiences, all of our experiences, are another way of translating this instead of suffering is unsatisfactory. Because if we can really realize this, we're going to stop looking out there for happiness, because we'll realize nothing out there is going to give us any sort of lasting, genuine happiness. At best, we'll have some transient pleasure. At worst, we'll create a lot of suffering by trying to grasp onto that pleasure. So if we come to realize this, and this is really to realize the nature of our very existence, that we're in this state, then from this, we're going to turn our attention inwards. And we're going to look for the source of suffering and happiness inwards. So by realizing this, we'll be able to develop renunciation to the aspiration for nirvana, understanding that the real source of suffering and happiness is within ourselves. Then, of course, we need a method to achieve nirvana. So we need the third insight here, no self. To come to realize no self. Because here in the Theravada tradition, what is the root of samsara, what is underlying all of our suffering, is, of course, a false view of reality. And it's the false view of how we see ourselves as a person. We overinflate the sense of me. We believe that there's an autonomous, self-sufficient me here. We believe there's a self, autonomous, self-sufficient me here. We grasp onto that, and that's what we believe how we exist. If we come to realize we do not exist in this overinflated, autonomous way, we'll overcome all of our mental afflictions and suffering. We will achieve nirvana. So this Vipassana practice in the Theravada enables us to achieve nirvana. Now, here we have to be very careful, this word self. There is no Buddhist tradition that says there's no me, no person. All Buddhist traditions are trying to see how do we exist, not whether or not we exist. We do exist. The question is how we exist. And here in the Theravada traditions, they're saying we do not exist in this way as a self, autonomous, self-sufficient me. And if we realize that, we'll get rid of all of our mental afflictions, we'll achieve nirvana. So, when in a Theravada tradition, when they talk about Vipassana practice, they're talking about gaining these three insights. Any questions about Theravada before I move on to Mahayana? Anything there is not clear? No, here right mindfulness, and I'd have to check exactly how each of these eight practices are defined, but mindfulness is, in Buddhism, is simply to remember the object. The word mindfulness, and this is where often there's a lot of confusion as well. The word mindfulness is a translation of the Pali word sati, the Sanskrit word smriti. Both of those words literally mean memory, to remember. So mindfulness is our ability to remember the object. It's our ability to not forget the object. So this is the faculty of our mind that enables us to focus without becoming distracted. So we are to strengthen this in the concentration practice, because by strengthening our mindfulness, we develop better concentration. Then in the Vipassana practice, we apply that mindfulness. There's Vipassana practice called the four applications of mindfulness. We apply that mindfulness to investigate the nature of reality. But here, right mindfulness is simply the ability of focus. Okay, let's look at Mahayana. So as we saw earlier, that in the Mahayana traditions, based on the Sanskrit tradition, the goal of the spiritual path is enlightenment. Which is the further goal. So not only are we striving for personal liberation from suffering, nirvana, we're striving for the further goal of complete enlightenment, so that we can help to liberate everyone else from suffering. Someone who's achieved the goal of enlightenment, of course, is a Buddha. Like the Theravada, we first need to develop an aspiration to strive for the goal of enlightenment. So if we have this aspiration of renunciation, the wish for ourselves to be liberated, then on top of that, on the basis of that, we can understand, well, I'm not the only one stuck in this mess, everyone else is. So not only to develop the wish to be free ourselves, but to develop the wish to help free others. But then we can understand, well, in my current situation, I'm not much use to anyone. I have my own issues to work with. How can I be most effective in helping to liberate others? Is if I achieve enlightenment, then I can be very effective in helping others. So then that is the aspiration. We develop the aspiration for enlightenment so that we can help to liberate everyone else from suffering. This in Sanskrit is called bodhicitta. So bodhi is Sanskrit for enlightenment. Citta is Sanskrit for mind. So bodhicitta is literally the mind of enlightenment. It's the mind which aspires to enlightenment for the benefit of others. Once we develop this aspiration for enlightenment, we are called a bodhisattva. Again, bodhi is enlightenment. Sattva has many meanings. Here, it means courage or strength. So a bodhisattva is someone who has the courage or strength to strive for enlightenment. So when a bodhisattva achieves enlightenment, they become a Buddha. How do we achieve enlightenment? What are the practices? Normally in the Mahayana traditions, it's presented as the six perfections. And we can see these six perfections listed here. I won't go through them in detail because that's a whole teaching in itself. But again, like the Eightfold Path, we can condense these six perfections into the same three core areas of practice. Because the first three, generosity, ethics, and patience, can be condensed as ethics. Then, number five is concentration, number six is wisdom. And then joyous effort, the fourth one, is something we need to apply to all three. So in the Mahayana, also the six perfections is essentially the same three core areas of practice: ethics, concentration, wisdom. Here in the Mahayana, when we talk about the wisdom practice, the Vipassana practice, as we see here, we mainly talk about this wisdom of emptiness. In Sanskrit, shunyata. Because the Mahayana assertion is that, yes, we have this grasping onto this self, as we looked at earlier. You know, we believe there's an autonomous me here. But in the Mahayana, they say there's a deeper level of ignorance that we need to eliminate as well. Something deeper going on than just merely grasping onto autonomous self. At the deepest level, our false view of reality is grasping onto, believing there's an independent me here and an independent objective world out there. So this realization of emptiness is a realization there's no independent me, no independent objective world. Why? Because everything is interdependent. So this is a realization of emptiness. And by realizing this, we can overcome this ignorance, mental afflictions, and we can achieve the goal of enlightenment. So this, in the Mahayana traditions, when they talk about Vipassana practice, they're mainly talking about this wisdom of emptiness. In this retreat, we're following this Gelug Mahamudra, coming from within Tibetan Buddhism, coming from India, of course. Tibetan Buddhism is within the Mahayana tradition. So when we go into later in this text, Vipassana practice, This is what we're mainly going to be focusing on. This. Any questions about Mahayana? Then, to briefly complete this chart before we go for dinner, we'll look at what's called Vajrayana. Sometimes called Tantra. Now, Vajrayana, like Mahayana, has the same goal, enlightenment, so we have to develop the same aspiration, bodhicitta, and we have to develop the same vipassana practice, the wisdom of emptiness. So what's the difference? The difference being is the level of mind we use in the spiritual path. Both in the Theravada and Mahayana vehicles, we're trying to refine this, what's called the coarse mind, the mind that we have now, the mind that is active now. We're trying to refine that through our concentration practice. We're trying to make it more stable, more clear, more focused. Then we use that to penetrate the nature of reality to achieve nirvana or enlightenment. This could take a very long time. In the Vajrayana Tantra, there are practices to enable us to gain access to a deeper level of our mind. The most deep level of our mind, called the very subtle mind, very difficult to gain access to, but in Tantra Vajrayana, there are practices that help us to do that. We see them called here in the practices, generation stage, completion stage. So those two practices help us to gain access to this very subtle mind. Then we use that to realize emptiness. And because it's a very subtle mind, it's very powerful, which means we can wipe out ignorance and mental afflictions much more quickly using that level of our mind. And so that's why Tantra or Vajrayana can accelerate the spiritual path. It's said that in the best case scenario, we can achieve enlightenment in this very life using this. And then, of course, when people, Westerners like ourselves, hear this, they go, ooh, that's for me. I want that. This Theravada Mahayana stuff, oof, that looks like a lot of work. I'm not into that. This sounds like, you know, the super fast, exciting path. That's for me. I want that. Yeah, exactly. So then people jump into these generation and completion stage practices because they sound exciting and they promise a lot of reward very quickly. And then 10 years later, nothing has happened because it's just a game. Because for this to work effectively, as a basis, we need this. For this to work effectively, we need this as a basis. Does that mean we have to first go and find a Theravada tradition? No. What it means is the practices at this level are the foundation within the Mahayana traditions. And within the Mahayana traditions, within the Vajrayana traditions, and my understanding is that it's only within Tibetan Buddhism that has a complete system of Vajrayana practice within Buddhism still existing today, that within Vajrayana, included is all of these practices as a basis, as a foundation. So, therefore, here, the Mahamudra that we're going to focus on, of course, is within Mahayana tradition, within Tibetan Buddhism, and within Mahayana, within the Mahamudra, we also have the Vajrayana level or Tantra level of Mahamudra practice. So what we're going to find in the text is that also within Vajrayana, effectively we have the same three core areas of practice. We have ethics as the basis, which is actually contrary to popular belief. You know, often people feel like in Tantra, you know, everything, because I'm doing Tantra, then everything is okay. But actually that's a complete mistake. Each level that you go into, the ethics that we have to have as a basis becomes more difficult to follow. Mahayana ethics is more difficult than Theravada. Vajrayana ethics is much more difficult than Mahayana. An example here, the level of ethics that we're trying to sustain here at this level as a basis, an example is that if you give up love for even one single sentient being, this is considered a serious ethical downfall at this level of practice. That's the level of ethics that we have to sustain to be able to function well at this level of practice. So very difficult. So therefore, in this Mahamudra practice that we're going to look at through this text here, we're going to be looking, as I said earlier, three areas. Foundation, which covers a lot of practices here and here as the foundation. Shamatha practice, Vipassana practice, emptiness practice. But this can happen at both these levels. And sometimes the Mahayana level is called when this is called Tantra, this is often called Sutra. So what we're going to find in this text here is that when we come to the Vipassana practice, we have two levels of Vipassana practice, the Sutra level and the Tantra level. And because to practice Tantra Mahamudra effectively, we need this as a basis. So in the text, what we're going to find is that this level of Vipassana practice, is mentioned in one paragraph, saying this is sort of roughly what it is. You want to practice that? Then you need to do all of this. And that's what we're going to look at in the text. So we're going to look at the foundation practices. We're going to look at the shamatha practice here. And we're going to look at the vipassana practice at this level, the emptiness practice. And then we're going to briefly, in one paragraph, see, well, what's this look like when we get there eventually? So that's how the Mahamudra fits within these three vehicles. Any last questions before we go for dinner? I want to review a little bit of this tomorrow morning because modern studies have shown that if we don't review something that we hear, if we don't review it within 24 hours, we forget 75% of everything we hear. So we're going to try and avoid that by reviewing this tomorrow morning, and then hopefully we won't forget 75%, maybe only 50%. So at least we remember 50% instead of 25%. So that's the goal of why I want to do a review every morning briefly, what we did the previous 24 hours to keep it fresh in our mind. So we'll review a little bit this tomorrow morning, but last question before we go for dinner. I think everyone's looking for some dinner. So let's break for dinner and we'll come back at 7:30. And this evening I want to do an introduction into meditation generally so that we can launch into the meditation practice first thing tomorrow morning, the shamatha practice. And also we'll do a little meditation at the end of this evening as well. So that's this evening. So we'll see you back at 7:30. And again, I encourage you to chat this evening to get to know people in the group. So enjoy dinner, and I'll see you back at 7:30.